I'm talking by phone tonight with Amar Towles. He's a man of many interests, from 1950s jazz to 1970s cop shows, from Provence to Disneyland, from the cast of Casablanca to Bob Dylan in all of his phases, and he loves cookies baked by both his grandmothers. He's also a man of many talents. He's a principal at an investment firm in Manhattan, serves on the boards of the Library of America and the Yale Art Gallery, and recently published his first novel to great acclaim. It was named one of the 10 best novels of the year by the Wall Street Journal. It is titled Rules of Civility and has just recently come out in paperback. I'm happy to tell you that he will be here in Cincinnati at the main library downtown reading and signing Rules of Civility on Saturday, August 25th at 2 p.m. Welcome.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
Amar, I was literally transported back to Manhattan in 1938, seen largely through the eyes of a young woman whose name is Katie. If you would tell us who she is and talk a bit about two important people in her life, Evie and Tinker, and how their backgrounds differ.
Katie is a child of Russian immigrants, having grown up on the Lower East Side. So this book, which only covers really a year in her life, 1938, is capturing that moment where avenues are opening up for her, both socially and professionally. And at the time, when the book begins on New Year's Eve, she's at a low-rent jazz club with her boarding house roommate, Eve. And by chance, in walks a young man in a cashmere coat who takes the table next to them. His brother never shows up. And so the three of them start to get to know each other. And this chance meeting is really what lays the foundation for a sequence of events that will change the trajectory of Katie's life, as well as the lives of the other two people there. Tinker, from a background that is more of sort of a WASPy, well-to-do, and Eve, who's from the upper middle class in the Midwest. Each has sort of different social footing and professional footing. But as I say, this chance event is kind of what lays the foundation for a new direction in their lives.
And to some extent, Eve and Tinker are both a bit on the run from their lives, at least the way I saw it. You have mentioned chance, and I was struck by something that I read in your acknowledgments to a number of important people in your life. But you also express gratitude to, as you put it, chance for landing me so unexpectedly in New York.
Let me first say, I like when you made the observation that Tinker and Eve are to some degree running away from aspects of their life. I suppose that New York City, more than almost any city in the country, is one where almost everybody is running towards something or away from something or both things at once. People flocking here to pursue particular dreams or passions, in whether that's to make $1 million or to break into the world of fashion or of theater or of music or the arts. So it is a group where are running here really in pursuit of a passion as young people. And there are certainly a lot of young New Yorkers who come here because they're trying to get away from the expectations that were of them and from where they were from. You have that 200-year-old cliche, which is still valid, of people leaving smaller town environments to come to the big city and see sort of its glamour and its opportunity. So kind of in a way, almost everybody in New York City for 100 years has been running in one direction or the other, or both, as I say. And that adds to this element that the city is one where chance can play a big role in one's lives, because these people continue to come here at the age of 20 or 23 or 24, and they've come here for their passion or to run away from their experiences, let's say. And when they go out to dinner with their roommate, and the roommate brings his girlfriend and she brings her roommate, who brings her friend from high school, as you go around the table, what you end up with is this terrific variety of backgrounds, of personality types, of careers, of ambitions. And that just means that seat you take, you know, where someone's to your left and someone to your right, something's opening up for you, an avenue of life that you would not have necessarily anticipated the day before. Whether that encounter leads to romance or to a new direction in your profession or both. And I think the city is very much like that. And that time of life is very much like that. And the book is clearly trying to capture that moment in life in the mid-20s when everything feels very haphazard. You happen to go to a restaurant. You happen to sit next to somebody. You happen to bump into somebody at a museum or what have you. And that time of life, it is sort of haphazard. But somewhere along the way, that person you're dating becomes your spouse. That fifth apartment you live in becomes your neighborhood. That fourth internship you have becomes your career. And at the time, you don't really know which of those little sort of spur-of-the-moment decisions or chance elements is going to become the defining factor of your adult life. And it all feels sort of loose-knit and random in a fabulous way. So the book is certainly trying to capture that moment in time. And I think that's been a reality for 100 years, as I say, and that was certainly my experience in coming to the city at the age of 25.
One of the fascinating things about your book is that you've taken a moment in time, so to speak, 1938 Manhattan, and put it together with something from a much earlier time, which are the actual rules of civility. So what are they? Who created them? How did you combine these two things?
The title of the book references a list that George Washington compiled as a young man, really a teenager, which he called the Rules of Civility and Decent Behavior, which was 110 maxims, half of which are really rules of manners, you know, don't talk with your mouth full, and half of which are more moral maxims about being honest and being having integrity, taking care of those in need, etc. And Washington didn't invent this list, but he did write it down as a young man because he aspired to living up to that list. And there's a long tradition of this. Actually, a lot of the founding fathers were drawing this kind of a list out of the Enlightenment era. And Franklin wrote about certain elements of this. Jefferson did, too. And it really dates all the way back to the era of chivalry. Today, we really think of manners and morals as almost two different things. But it's helpful to remember that for much of history, they were the same thing. If you went back to the era of chivalry, a knight was supposed to comport himself well at court. He was supposed to be polite and know his place. But he also was supposed to be true to the king and risk his life for a damsel in distress and never lie, etc. And for the knight, it wasn't manners or morals. That was just being knightly. It involved both of those things. And that tradition kind of got passed right down through the Renaissance into the Enlightenment and to the aristocracy in England and France and ultimately the United States, because it ultimately became what it is to be a gentleman. A gentleman did both of these things, and that's what Washington wanted to become. He wanted to be a gentleman in both manners and morals, and saw that as sort of one and the same thing. And so my book, which is really a novel of manners, where every character is conscious of how they're speaking or behaving, and to some degree using the manner in which they speak or behave to influence the judgments of others, much as we do today, whether that's to put themselves on a slightly higher social standing than they probably deserve, or a lower one, because they're interested in slumming it, let's say. But either way, they're conscious of how they behave, and they use their behavior to position themselves, and often this has moral implications. They're just sort of thinking of it as navigating the social sphere, but inevitably you end up with risks of compromise, and the characters have to grapple with that too. So having well into the drafting of the novel, I did stumble across this list, and just it stood out for me as the perfect consolidation of these ideas, and the fact that it had been penned by the founder of our country as a teenager was sort of all the more striking and entertaining for me, and so it found its way as a meaningful metaphor within the story.
Well, and for me, what was interesting is to juxtapose it against what felt like a theme running through the book that's perhaps best summed up by the carving over the woman's hotel where Katie and Evie reside, translates from the Latin as place no trust in appearance. Do you want to say just a little bit about those, how those two things fit with each other in this novel?
Yes. I mean, you're certainly in a world where people are manipulating their behavior or their clothes or their accent to either be accepted or to impress or what have you. It is a world where appearances may begin to diverge with reality. And so, yes, that motto was a historically accurate motto from the elevator bank of a very high-end apartment building here in the New York and Beresford. And, of course, they meant it as in, this is the best place to live in the city. These are high-quality buildings. But the character sort of recognizing that motto sees to some degree the more social irony, I suppose, in it, in herself and her circle. But I think that, you know, if you go back to that list of Washington's maxims again, one of the interesting things about human behavior, and there's actually a lot of science about this now today, that if you try to practice being good, you can change your moral behavior by the way you practice your behavior. You build habits. And we say thank you and teach our children that. Keep saying thank you, say please, respect your elders. We're trying to develop that habit in them, but there's a lot of moral philosophy behind instructing our children to do that. It's not important that they say thank you. It's important that they be grateful. It's not important that they say please in and of itself. It's important, again, that they show respect and know their place. So I kind of like that, too, the fact that while that motto, place no trust in appearances, there's some accuracy to that, of course, that some people do misrepresent themselves, and you can't judge a book by its cover, the other cliche for that. But on the other hand, as a young person, if you're trying to become somebody of a certain moral type, you do it through changing your appearance, changing your practices, and with the hopes that eventually it becomes who you are at the core. And both of those things are possible.
It's a wonderful read, and I thoroughly enjoyed reading Rules of Civility, and I've thoroughly enjoyed talking with you tonight. I hope you will be back with more.
Thank you. I'm closing out a short story right now that follows one of the characters in the book at the tail end of the book, and then I'll move on to a new book later this summer. But I'm very much looking forward to my visit to your city.
That's wonderful news. Thanks for being with us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
I've been talking with Amor Towles tonight. His best-selling novel, Rules of Civility, is now out in paperback, and you will be able to meet and hear him in person when he comes to the Downtown Public Library on Saturday, August 25th at 2 p.m. You'll find more information at wvxu.org. For Around Cincinnati, I'm Barbara Gray.